Translation by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. Jai. The young Brahmana continued, "My dear sir, you are very merciful and you know everything. Therefore, kindly be a witness in this case. A person who knows things as they are and still does not bear witness becomes involved in sinful activities." Purport: the dealings between a devotee and the Lord are very simple. The young Brahmana said to the Lord, "You know everything, but if you do not bear witness, you will be involved in sinful activities. There is no possibility, however, of the Lord's being involved in sinful activities. A pure devotee, even though he knows everything of the Supreme Lord, can speak with him exactly as if he were a common man. Although the dealings between the Lord and his devotee are always very simple and open, there is formality. All these things happen because of the connection between the Lord and the devotee." Srila Prabhupada ki. Om Jnanati Virandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Rival. Okay. Is that better? Okay. Ribol. So the pastime continues, the adventure continues. And here we are witness to the conversation of this young Brahmana to the Supreme Lord himself. And a very interesting way of speaking to the Supreme Lord. He's almost chastising the Supreme Lord. He's giving him a nice request, but also saying, "This is what you should do," which is a very interesting approach. But as Prabhupada says, this is only possible because of the connection between the Lord and the devotee. So there is this interesting connection or interesting consideration always between natural, pure reciprocation, which is unimpeded by formality, which is, of course, as we know, a trait of Vrindavan consciousness. We sing about that during the Damodar pastime, that the lack of formal regalia, the lack of formal approach is something that's valued, just sweet, intimate, natural. But at the same time, formality, as Prabhupada says, has to be observed. So it's an interesting combination of factors that we all have to work with. Because we are learning to be a devotee of Krishna. And we also read about many, many devotees like this who are very intimately connected to Krishna. And so we have to be careful that we act correctly according to our own platform and not necessarily the platform of all the exalted devotees that we read and hear about. If we do that, or if we don't follow that rule, then the chance of sahajiya behavior is very likely. And that is the definition of sahajiya, to be doing something, to be acting on a platform that you're not actually situated. So we need formality in our dealings with the Lord, because we typically are used to dealing with people in this world. And we also know that within this world, there's a hierarchy of how we interact with others. So with some people, we're very formal, we're very respectful. And typically the higher a person is placed, either by position or role, we would typically offer more respect or be very much more cautious in their presence. As Prabhupada would give many examples, you know, if you want to see the president, President Nixon, he would say, you want to see President Nixon, you can't just go there and see him. If you want to see Mahatma Gandhi, you can't just go there and see him. You have to go through a whole process. So there's a formality, a certain reverence and a certain nature of being aloof and hidden also, based upon the person's position and status. So we have that understanding just through the modern world that there are different ways to interact with different people. But then there is always this wonderful dimension of intimate exchange as well. And Prabhupada gives the example that a man goes to the office and he works hard all day, and he may be a manager, a big person in the office, and everyone is offering him respect, saying, "You big manager, please give me a nice salary." You know, trying to please the manager in different ways and offering him all sorts of respect. But then when he comes home, he's at home with his son, with his children, and the son says, "Daddy, I want to climb on your back." And immediately gets down on all fours and starts running around the room just like a humble servant. So that there's an intimacy there which transcends a formality in different situations. So the same person, he's the same person. The same person who's the big CEO or the big manager in the office who's offered respect is now running around dealing with his son in a very subservient manner. So subservience and position are not contradictions. In fact, in devotional life, when someone acts in a leadership position or a managerial position, it is meant to be from a position of subservience. It might not always come out like that, but the ideal is that it should be servant leadership. That as a servant, you lead because it will serve Krishna. And that is a nice way to conduct affairs within the spiritual society. That clearly leadership is required, but that leadership should not be done on the basis of anyone thinking I'm better than anyone else, or that indeed anyone else has to and must listen to what I say because I am superior. Now there are clearly persons who are superior. There are clearly persons, and we all naturally bow down to them, offer them respect. Our own spiritual masters, as an example, we naturally offer them respect because they deserve it. They command respect. There's always the dilemma, command or demand. Those who are unqualified typically demand respect. "Look, I have a big position. You must respect me because I have the position." And then there are others who have a position, but they're not so bothered about that. But naturally, due to their conduct, they command respect. So one great example of that for me is Mother Kalangana. Because Mother Kalangana always conducted herself in a very nice, saintly manner. She didn't really have any position. She had no formal position. But through her dedication over years, years of service, years of sadhana, years of demonstrated behavior, years of interaction with devotees, she had a whole group of following. She had a whole group of followers who would come and listen to her speak on the Bhagavatam, listen to her chastisements, listen to her encouragements. It was wonderful to see that here is a person who naturally has conducted themselves in such a manner that everyone feels a natural sense of reverence too. It's very, very inspiring when that's the case. The opposite isn't always so inspiring, and people can normally detect it straight away. But out of formality, they carry on. So here, this concept, this dynamic comes out in this pastime. It's come out earlier in the interactions of the young brahmana with the family members of the older brahmana, the diplomatic ways that they wanted to maneuver the situation. They even were prepared to make an allegation, or it might come a few verses later, that this younger brahmana is actually, he's actually doing all this just in order to, he served the older brahmana with the intention of getting something from him, because he knows he's a wealthy person. So they made up all of these allegations. So here in this verse, there's an interaction which is similar to that, but just between the Lord and the devotee. And so the young brahmana is saying to the Lord that if a person knows things as they are and they still do not bear witness, they become involved in sinful activities. So that's a very interesting, concept, but why do I say it's similar? Because it's still based on the concept of truthfulness. And truthful dealings mean that we are also straightforward. And so if there is someone in an assembly who is witnessing something inappropriate going on, and I think I touched on this in a previous class, like Bhishmadev, you know, he was in that assembly and Draupadi was being, you could say, abused pretty much, as indeed all the Pandavas were. And he was silent, and many others were silent. Now we can pick out Bhishmadev, because he's an exalted devotee. And the Lord specifically used Bhishmadev in order to give these lessons to people. So we don't look at Bhishma Dev in a lesser light as a result of this, ultimately. But we do look at the actual interactions and we analyze the interactions for what they are, somewhat independent of the person directly involved. So just like Bhishma Dev was in the assembly and he felt unable to speak. Now, there were very valid reasons why he felt unable to speak, but still he didn't speak, and neither did many of the others, Dronacharya and so many others. And that ultimately was not appreciated by Krishna. Those dealings were not appreciated by Krishna. That even if you are doing something which appears to be correct according to your codes of dharma and etiquette and seniority, you've actually done something that's not correct. You should have not allowed this incident to happen. And of course, Dhritarashtra is there. He's permitting the whole thing to go on. Duryodhana is the instigator. It's a really disastrous situation. So here, this brahmana is saying to the Lord, you know how things are, and you know the reality and the truth. So don't remain silent. You are now the witness, and I'm calling upon you. If you do not do this, you may be involved in sinful activities. And this is where Prabhupada says that the Lord can never be involved in sinful activities, regardless of what he does. Because actually the definition of sin or piety for us is what the Lord approves of and what he doesn't approve of. Now there are different discussions on sin and piety. And we know there's standard descriptions. There are lists of things we should do. There are lists of things we shouldn't do. Well, in the 11th canto, there's an interaction between Uddhava, I think, and Krishna, and they discuss this concept of sin. And Krishna is advising that don't worry about piety and impiety. These things are all to be given up. And Uddhava asks the question, but, you know, the whole all of the scriptures, they're constantly talking about sinful behavior, pious behavior. And you're now saying, give it all up. It's a similar analogy to Arjun's question to Krishna. When Krishna is saying, when Arjun says to Krishna, first of all, Krishna, you say we should renounce work. We should renounce all work, third chapter. And then you say we should work in devotion. So which is it? I'm confused. So Uddhava asks the same thing, but just on this subject of pious and impious. And Krishna responds and says that actually piety and impiety isn't really determined by any particular actions, any particular description of an action. Rather, it is determined by whether one is following their prescribed duty or not. Whether one is following their allocated duty or their prescribed duty is the actual determining factor for whether something is pious or impious. And that's very interesting. As long as that prescription is given by a saintly person or an advanced person, if one follows it, then the definition of whether they're being pious or impious depends on how well they're following that duty. And that's interesting. Because obviously, as we know, in different circumstances, in different situations, what is pious in one situation may be impious in another. So that's the whole dynamic. Now, most of the time, there isn't so much of a conflict. Certain standards are clear. You know, we shouldn't steal, we shouldn't lie, we shouldn't cheat, we shouldn't cause harm to others, we shouldn't kill animals, we shouldn't do this, shouldn't do that. But for every one of those items that I've just mentioned, you can probably think of a situation where it might be legitimate. For example, Prabhupada says that if a person, in a civilian, kills another person, that's considered murder. But if a warrior, if a soldier in the army kills an enemy soldier, that is not considered murder. That is considered doing his job. So there's so much dynamic involved. And therefore scripture is something that's very interesting, also very tricky. We have to be careful that when we read scripture and if we become a little familiar with scripture, you know, after some years we might think, okay, I've read quite a bit, I've studied quite a bit, I've done Bhakti Shastri, I've even done Bhakti Vaibhav, and I'm aspiring for Bhakti Vedanta, and then maybe a few other degrees after that. We might think, okay, I've got it now. I know now what is to be done in all situations, all circumstances. And yes, I'm it. I'm the expert. If you have any issues, consult me. We might think that. But it's dangerous. Because ultimately, we have to have a deep understanding of situations. We have to have a deep understanding of Shastra. we also have to have some shakti given to us by the Lord. And no amount of study or personal endeavor ever results in the Lord giving us empowerment. That is purely His desire. All we do when we engage in our service, our sadhana, our study, or whatever it is, we simply make an appeal to the Lord. My dear Lord, please empower me. Now, He doesn't have to follow that. He doesn't have to oblige to that request. He's not so subservient to us as He may be here to this brahmana. And it's a difference which comes according to our level of advancement, our status within the Lord's consciousness, how we interact with the Lord. To what extent are we dear to the Lord, and to what extent is the Lord dear to us? Now, those two things actually go together. It's not that the Lord neglects us, despite all the devotional service we're doing. Why doesn't the Lord interact with me? It's about time, Lord. I've been here for 10 years now. I've been doing devotional service. I even did a Mangal transfer the other day. Now, come on. Give me some reciprocation. give me something. Well, the Lord is probably assessing us on a different set of parameters. And it is actually a direct reciprocation. To the extent that we are absorbed in thoughts of the Lord, to that extent, the Lord is also thinking of us. What is that? Shivaram Maharaj's book, Hridayam Manyam, Mayam, the sadhus are my heart. I am in the heart of the sadhus, and the sadhus are in my heart. So to the extent that we are, our entire engagement, consciousness is dovetailed to the Lord and completely absorbed in the Lord, then Krishna is also connected with us in the same way. Lord Chaitanya said, no, that whenever someone is chanting the holy name, he's personally present. When there is Harinam Sankirtan going on, the Lord manifests. Lord Nityananda manifests also. So it's full reciprocation. You can't really have one without the other, because they are very much interconnected items. So if you have a person like this young brahmana, who is very much connected to the Lord, he can address him in this manner. He can say, one who does not bear witness can be involved in sinful activities. Now, from Prabhupada's purport, we know that this isn't really directly for the Lord. It is the devotee's friendly interaction with the Lord. But for us, this is a very good lesson. That sin is a very real thing for us. For the Lord, it isn't. Because as I mentioned, the definition of what is sinful or not is determined by the Lord. So whatever he thinks is good is actually correct. And if he has decided to do something and he wants us to do something, that becomes our prescribed duty, and therefore not following it becomes sin. So that's very interesting. But for us, sin and piety are real concepts. And there's a whole cycle which is described, I think it's touched on in the Gita and also in the Nectar of Devotion in particular, about how the whole range of factors are involved in sin, with inclination, desire, etc. So it doesn't really matter at which stage in the cycle you consider it to be the starting point, because it's a cycle, and it's a vicious cycle. it's not a fun cycle to be trapped in. So you have a general circumstance which this whole propensity to commit sin arises due to avidya, ignorance. And avidya is the sort of starting point of our entrance into this world. One of the earliest elements or items manifested by Lord Brahma is ignorance in his creation. Because obviously the blueprint for the whole creation is already created by the Supreme Lord. But then Lord Brahma acts and manifests different things. He manifests the circumstances in which we operate. He also manifests a different species, as we know from the Bhagavatam, from different parts of his body. He produces different species, different living entities, and casts them off, and they take their real forms. And that's part of the creation, the secondary creation conducted by Lord Brahma. So it starts with avidya, ignorance. And this ignorance leads to, you can call bija, a seed, which is, what is that seed? Seed is described as desire, the desire for some kind of sinful activity. We'll only focus on sinful activities here because many of the items could be also used to refer to pious activities, probably the same elements within the cycle, just with their corresponding opposite. So desire is there, and that leads to sin. When you do something, you perform an activity, pap, which is sin. The consequence of that pap is that we end up with suffering, which is called klesha. So this is like a very, very simple four-step process. You know, you start with avidya, you end up with bija, you start with avidya, that leads to bija, some desire. Then you perform pap, you do something, some activity. The consequence of that is you suffer, klesha. So then there's a slightly more elaborate a description of that. Let's say you start with desire, bija. You have a desire to do something. Then at some point you engage in that activity, pap. You actually commit some activity. Now that then has two consequences. It has a manifest consequence and an unmanifest consequence. So it has prarabdha and aprarabdha. So prarabdha is the manifest consequence of performing a sinful activity. Now sometimes that we're able to detect that. Sometimes we can, or we might be able to detect it, or we think we can. That sometimes something happens to us as a consequence of an activity that we've done. And we can connect the two things. We can say that I made this offense, I did this activity, I did this, and as a consequence this has happened to me. Sometimes it might be very clear. Sometimes prarabdha karma manifests in bodily features. You know, it manifests in terms of different unfavorable circumstances. Could be bodily abilities, bodily different items. Could be something more subtle to do with the subtle body. Could be some deficiency in mental capacity. Could be something wrong with the intelligence. Could be someone exceptionally puffed up on the ego side. So you have all the physical things that could go wrong with the body. Someone could be disabled. Someone could be rather ugly. Someone could be not very strong. You know, all the opulence is the opposite of. Each person's got a different dose of something in this world. Gross body and subtle body. All are handicaps. You know, you start off, you run a race sometimes. And sometimes someone runs a race with a handicap. They're given a handicap because of some punishment or something or other. For the whole race, they're handicapped by something. So that's what actually happens in life also. We each go through life, we go through life, and each of us has a different menu of handicaps. Different menu. Special selection of items. Except in this life, we can't select them. We chose the menu in the previous life. And previous lives to that. Previous several lives. And they all resulted in a set of maybe unspoken choices, which have now resulted in what the waiter has served us in this life, which is a special set of problems. And so that's also a type of prarabdha karma, where it is a manifestation, a situation a person has in this life by which they can interact in the world. So then there's the other side, the aprarabdha, the unmanifest aspect. And that is a little more tricky, because that unmanifest aspect, one of the items of it is, it leads to a type of addiction. Now, if you remember the process, you've had a desire, you've performed some activity. Now, that activity has produced some visible results, and there are also some invisible results. One of the invisible results is that you've become addicted to that activity. That's subtle and it's invisible. So that addiction, you can also say, is a type of inclination. So then you have an inclination to now go back to the initial starting step, which is a desire. So in one sense, you could say this inclination is the start of the cycle. But as I mentioned, there's probably not much point trying to figure out which part of the cycle you've entered from. It could be anywhere. You could just spontaneously perform some sin. And this is actually a very interesting point, because in the past, and we read about sages, great Vaishnavas in the Bhagavatam, if they perform some sinful activity, first of all, they do not do sinful activity as a rule. They don't do it. So when it happens, it's not because of that they've had an inclination and a desire to perform the sinful activity. It's happened, just happened. When it happens, they are very, very afraid of the consequences of that. They are very afraid that even though they didn't want to do it, it's happened. And there is now a consequence to the fact that I did this. There's going to be a consequence, possibly external, which they're not generally too worried about, but they're worried about the subtle consequence, the unmanifest. The fact that they're now going to be habituated to this activity. By doing an activity, you become habituated to it, which can work both ways. If we do a devotional activity and we become habituated to it, that's good, because becoming addicted to service is a great thing. But being addicted to activities for sense gratification is a problem, because all it does is creates in us, in our consciousness, a greater and greater propensity to do more of the same, which then leads to sin naturally. So this is interesting that sages say they enter at this part of the cycle where they perform some sinful activity somehow. They repent immediately. They are so ashamed of themselves. They regret their behavior so much. And one example is Parikshit Maharaj. Through a moment of, you could say, personal emergency, frustration, circumstance, all arranged by the Lord, of course, he put this garland around the neck of this shoulder, around the neck of this rishi. Now, he wouldn't have done this. This garland, this snake. Shri Shri Radha Gokula Nanda Ki Jai. Anytime now. I hope. Shri Shri Radha Gokula Nanda Ki. So he garlanded this rishi with this dead snake. Immediately he regretted it. As soon as he got back, he was thinking, what have I done? What is this horrendous activity that I have performed? And he was thinking, this is not me. I do not identify with this. I'm disgusted by it. And he was thinking how to repent, how to overcome this problem. When the news eventually came to him that actually you've been cursed and that's it. In 7 days you will die. This bird, snake bird, will come and that's the end of it. And Parikshit Maharaj was happy. So he said, excellent, let this snake bird come, because what I've done is so much more severe than chastisement from the snake bird. Let this come and deal with my issues. So whichever part of the cycle you enter from, you carry on and you're trapped. And this addiction part is the more interesting one, because it's unseen. We develop a propensity to do certain things and we develop an inclination to do it. So we're inclined to something. Let's say we're attracted to some sense gratification, we do some sense gratification activity, we then have an inclination to that for the future. So then what happens is, that at some point, that manifests, according to circumstance, maybe from impetus from others also, it may manifest into a desire. It becomes more concrete. You can see it's becoming more solid. Just the addiction, the inclination is becoming, turning more into an actual desire. A desire, a plan of action. I must get this. And then, the manifestation of that is the pap, the activity, the actual performance of an activity that fulfills that. This is why we say thinking, feeling and willing. Those are three stages. You think about something. You could sort of draw an analogy with this, what I've said. The inclination could be a bit like thinking. Or you could say in another analysis, if you wanted, you could say it's the actual desire, the starting point of the desire. Thinking, you just think about a concept. You just have something in your mind. Then you feel, you get into it. you really become absorbed in it. You start to imagine that happening. It churns itself in your mind, and you're now participating in it on a subtle platform. So then the next stage of that is the gross manifestation of it. So it always starts from subtle. Finer stages of subtle lead to something very gross. And that's the secret. That if we actually... It's on your knee, Prabhu. Prajan Prabhu. Oh. Gauranga. So, our attempt as sadhakas is in some ways is to attack this cycle from all directions, isn't it? The gross materialists typically deal with and try to control the gross manifestation, so they restrict people. If someone commits a sin, they go to prison. Now they also are starting more and more to do some educational stuff in prison, which is hopefully meant to change a person's character. Sometimes works, sometimes doesn't work. If it worked, you wouldn't have repeat offenders. If it doesn't work, or if the person doesn't participate in the cycle, then they offend again. So it's actually another good way to look at it. As a person who's being punished, that is our performance of this cycle of bap. So we attack this from all dimensions. We attack the gross, first of all, by restriction. So Prabhupada has given us items that we must not do. Meat eating, intoxication, illicit sex, gambling. So we restrict the actual activity. But we all know that just restricting an activity doesn't really work long term. We might do it for some time, but ultimately, because things actually come from the subtle and then manifest into gross, that is not sufficient for a lifetime of devotional service. And it's just the basic starting point to at least for us to start reducing the addiction side of it, to start reducing the sin that we are increasing and creating, and then the consequence of that, the addiction and the inclination. So that is not sufficient. So therefore, we also attack the other items, the inclination side of it. We understand how to stop the roots of sinful desire from taking hold. I've forgotten the verse. Anyway, maybe someone can remind me. It's a verse which explains that the roots of sinful desire, the roots of sinful activity, can be weeded out only by pure devotional service. Only by pure devotional service do we actually destroy the roots of sinful activity, such that they may not return. No other process does this. No other process of sinning, atonement, can do this. Can anyone think of the verse? Kechit kevalaya bhaktya vasudeva parayanaha agam dunvanti karsyena niharam iva bhaskaraha. Just as the fog is dissipated by the sun's rays. You know, in Mayapur, if you go, you see in the morning there's a nice mist of fog kind of thing. And the sun rises, and after some time it's gone completely. Just as the fog is dissipated by the sun's rays, so the roots of the propensity for sinful action are destroyed by the process of devotional service. Nothing else, no other process in the Vedas deals with this point. It allows us to enter this cycle somehow and stop it. The only thing the performance of regulations from the Vedas does is restrains different portions of this cycle. It restrains the activity, or it restrains by conditioning our mind. But if the ultimate inclination, the root cause, which is avidya, ignorance, the desire to enjoy in this world, if that is not weeded out, the cycle continues. Maybe it's suspended for a period of time, then it starts up again. Maybe it starts up with different objects, different scenarios, different country, different people. Sometimes we think we've made a mess of it in one place, so we go somewhere else. And people do this all the time. You know, they leave maybe the country they were born and brought up in, and they go somewhere else because they think this has all gone wrong here. I just had enough. I just want a fresh start. People try it. They leave their jobs. You know, they think, oh God, I've had enough of this. Let me try something new. These days, they leave their partners also. Okay, I've had enough of that now. 20 years, that's enough. Let's find another one. Let's try it again. Different set of options. Well, the fact is that, okay, you can change the circumstance, you can change the externals, but if you're carrying with you all the same propensities, the same inclinations, and the same, almost a step behind the propensities, the item of avidya and desire to enjoy that causes you to keep develop going through this cycle, it might not have such a permanent effect. Different people dream of different things. You know, there's the American dream. One point in the past, the streets of London were paved with gold. There was a song about that. So everyone wanted to come to uncover the gold. But when they arrived, what did they find? They found it was rather dirty. So this is the advert. This is the advertising campaign versus the reality. Sometimes it's funny, if you travel, of course it's much restricted these days. You go to Heathrow and you see a nice big billboard, nice poster, and it says, look at this, there's a nice picture of a sea, you know, some water sports going on, some sand, some big buildings, and it says, come to Dubai. Enjoy. Then when you go to Dubai, there's another poster there. Come to London. So this is how it goes. Each person is traveling from one place to another, thinking that by traveling, their problems will be solved. All that happens, you just get a different recipe. You just get a different set of options. But the root is all still there. The avidya, you've still taken that with you. The propensity for sinful acts, you've taken it with you. The desire for fruitive enjoyment, you've taken that with you. So do we really expect a different result? The result is probably the same thing that happened here, will just happen there with just a different flavor. That's all. But sometimes it's useful. That's why we do retreats. Retreats are good because they take you out of a space. They take you out of a certain space where you're conditioned and you're in a routine, and that routine is trapping you. And they put you somewhere where you could have a chance to explore something. So that's good. But as an expectation that you can be on the retreat forever, that's maybe a little unreasonable. Although we would probably like the retreats to go on forever, especially if we're in a swanky hotel and, you know, the breakfast is chapan bhog and we've eaten so much we can't have lunch, and then you go for a swim in the sea and you know those retreats. Very desirable. If we think that's going to go on forever, then we're fooling ourselves. So we have to just be realistic. This cycle is a real cycle. It's a dangerous one. And therefore this point is mentioned just in passing to the deity here. That if a person knows things as they are and they do not bear witness, they become involved in sinful activities. So here is a person who should act in a certain way. And now this is a slightly different dimension. This is now talking about the inaction aspect. So I've so far spoken about action. You know, we have a thought, we develop a desire, we do an action. Here, it's being flipped around, and the idea is through inaction, you are committing sin. By not acting when you should, that is considered just as bad as acting when you... That is considered just as bad as acting when inappropriate. So that's interesting. If we have a responsibility, if we have a duty, we are expected to carry it out. Otherwise, it's neglect of duty. Dereliction of duty. You can be fired for dereliction of duty in some places. So, therefore, truthful representation is a duty of brahmanas. So especially of brahmanas, ultimately everyone is supposed to be truthful, but others aren't always truthful. As Prabhupada said, there is no honest businessman. You know that phrase he said, there's no honest businessman. He says, the one customer comes, he says, for you, I'm giving you the best price. And then the next one comes, and the businessman says, for you, I'm giving you the best possible price. No one else has ever had this price before. Can they both be correct? No, so there's no honest businessman, Prabhupada says. And in the Kshatriya domain, there are different dealings, diplomacies, things like that, that sometimes go on. So these brahmanas are supposed to be truthful, and therefore actually representing accurately the truth is important. If some situation requires clarification, and there is a campaign or an agenda to suppress the truth, that is not considered very brahminical or indeed devotional. We have to be careful. Sometimes it happens. Sometimes it happens that there is a plan, there is an agenda, that the general situation must move in this direction. So if there is someone who might potentially be an obstacle to my plan moving in this direction, I will employ different tactics of duplicity, remaining silent when I shouldn't be, hiding facts, not revealing them. So it's dangerous. It might not manifest. Typically, this type of behavior doesn't always manifest immediately. Because probably we've all experienced circumstances where that's gone on. And it seems that the perpetrators simply just get away with it. They simply carry on, sometimes extensively. So as I mentioned last time, Krishna has a plan. And you know, we see, and in the Mahabharata this is described as well, that sometimes inappropriate things go on. And individuals carry on with inappropriate actions and deeds and behavior, but they are given, respect and support for an extensive period of time, facilitated by the Lord. And that's always a little bit of an uncomfortable one. Do you think, why doesn't the Lord put a stop to it? This is going on, why doesn't he stop it? You can do it instantly. Krishna, come on. I mean, you can only say that if you're on the level of this brahmana. Otherwise, Krishna's thinking, really, is that what you want? What do you know? There's so much more involved than what you think you know. And Krishna has his plan. And generally we know that Krishna will correct things. He generally does. Sometimes he doesn't. That's again his plan. Because ultimately he has a bigger plan for this world. And in Kali Yuga the plan is degradation. It's not upliftment. It might be a shock to us, but things are not really supposed to be improving day by day in this Kali Yuga age. They're going to get worse and worse and worse. So there's a whole set of cycles, people, circumstances, philosophies propagating which are meant to just facilitate that ultimate plan. Now, we won't get into why that's an ultimate plan and why that's even desirable. That's a different kind of level of thinking with the Lord's ultimate plan. But that's the reality of it. So many things do not get resolved satisfactorily. Many injustices go unpunished. They become formulated. Injustices become formulated as the code of conduct for moving forward. You know, let's say someone goes through this cycle, develops an inclination, desire. They do something which is not quite correct. And they do it because that's all they think. Even if they think they're doing the right thing, all they end up doing is something incorrect. And then they do that, some result comes which externally appears to be good. Maybe wealth comes, maybe following comes, maybe whatever parameter they're measuring appears to have been increased. And of course we know that's led to an inclination and addiction. So they carry on doing it. That becomes formulated into the way of doing things. So that then becomes the standard by which future generations are taught. This is how you effectively conduct things. This is how you effectively manage. You do this. But actually what's happened is that something sinful has slipped in. And because it produced some result, which wasn't the ultimate result of pure devotional service, but it was some other result that you can measure and quantify, you think it's okay. So it's continued. So that's the danger of it. And as Kali Yuga proceeds, that will go on more and more and more. But with Krishna's involvement and the devotee's direct connection with Krishna, Krishna will interact with that devotee in a very friendly and open way. So he will accept such chastisement. He will accept his pure devotee telling him, Krishna, put a stop to this. It's not that eventually Krishna will correct the situation, as I was saying. The Pandavas had to wait 13 years, was it, in the forest? Lord Ramachandra exiled for so long. Injustices went on for a long period of time before they were corrected. Well, the pure devotee can request the Lord to correct them straight away. Here, this Brahmana is not saying, I'll just be calm and peaceful, and I'll just wait for the Lord to manifest himself. No, he says to the Lord, come on, Lord, sort it out. This is what I need. Please deal with this. And so the Lord and the devotee have a very special connection which cannot be understood by others. Others come to the Lord with all their demands. And they make demands without actually having the actual adhikar to make a demand. You know, if someone comes to you with a demand and you don't know the person, or you're not on particularly friendly terms with the person, someone comes to you and gives you a demand, you will probably have a less of an inclination to carry it out than if you have a connection with the person. Sometimes the most unpleasant demand, if it is asked by someone who has a good connection with us, you'll do it. Because you know there's a trust, there's a level of trust. Whereas when trust is broken, it's difficult to fix it. And so typically when requests come, when orders come, orders to the Lord, orders to us, the degree of reciprocation that we have or the Lord has depends on our connection with the person. So typically it's recommended in the Shastra that Sri Sri Radha Gokula Nanda Ki. Typically it's recommended in the Shastra that there is a process to be followed. In the Bhagavatam this is described. A process to be followed before making a request of the Lord. It says, because in the Bhagavatam, different persons have made requests of the Lord. And it typically always starts off with a set of glorification prayers of the Lord. My dear Lord, you are the supreme controller of the entire universe. You are the manifester of everything, unmanifest, unmanifest. You control all the living entities. You are the master of the material energy. You are the superintendent of the modes. You are the Lord of all the devotees. You deliver punishment to the miscreants. You deliver rewards to the pious. There's a whole set of prayers where one glorifies the Lord, glorifies his position, pleases him, tries to please him, glorifies others who are dear to the Lord. Then one makes a request to the Lord. Then one makes the request, whether it's Diti's request, please let my sons be victorious and please let Indra be destroyed. Something like that, or some other request. It's always done with this starting point of formality. Starting point of formal approach to the Lord. You are the Supreme Lord, you are the greatest, you are the Lord, and I'm humbly putting this petition in front of you. That please fulfill my desire. So that is a tip for us to avoid becoming a sahajiya. Acting as if we are on the platform of this young Brahmana when we're not. So by maintaining that formality, we will be able to approach the Lord correctly, deal with him correctly, and as a parallel activity, we will actually start developing intimacy and connection with the Lord through hearing about him, through chanting his glories, through pastimes such as the Damodar Leela. Those are leelas that we don't really have entrance into, but at some point we are given a glimpse of what this pure, sweet interaction is. We're not really allowed there. But they're put before us as an enticement, as a demonstration of what is possible for a pure devotee. What type of interaction can one have with the Lord? So we meditate on that and we absorb our consciousness. But we still act with formality. So that's why typically deity worship is... We know he's Krishna, but he's largely worshipped as Narayan. Lakshmi Narayan is the mode of worship. But he's Krishna. So Prabhupada installed Krishna everywhere, specifically, not deities of Narayan. But he's mentioned that the mode of worship should be with a certain awe, reverence and formality, so that things do not become trivialized. So it's a big subject how to maintain this balance of truthfulness, intimacy. Sorry, between formality and intimacy, between pious, impious. But I'll stop there and see if anyone has any questions, corrections, comments. I did go a little bit over. Ian Prabhu?
Thank you so much for the class, Navadvip Chandra Prabhu. Very, very nice. And how you displayed it was very, very effective. I had a question in regards to something you spoke on uprooting the weeds. You know, it can only be done through devotional service, or pure devotional service, which is the level we're trying to get to. On, let's say, for our circumstances where, you know, we have some already, you know, a prarabdha that's been established there, and that's have kind of built for some time until we've come to devotional service, and we're trying to clear it out. Now, you mentioned how, you know, you have momentary times where it seemingly has left, but then it remanifests, and you probably make these restrictions, and then it leaves. And so naturally, we have this level of confidence that we're trudging on effectively, but then it comes back again and puts us into like a downward spiral. So how can we know that it's actually gone completely and not have that risk? Or what can we do to secure ourselves and not, you know, avoid the risk?
We do have to secure ourselves. It's important. In the beginning, as Lord Chaitanya mentions, it's described in the teachings of Lord Chaitanya that a gardener, you know, he puts a very strong fence around a small creeper which is growing, so that the other animals and things won't come and attack it. And you've probably seen those in parks. You know, we have them here also to protect the base, the little seedling that's just growing. And then it needs watering, it needs food, it needs so many things. And that whole process causes this thing to blossom and flourish. So we do have to be very careful to protect it. So it's good that we're thinking like that. Now, you said, when do we get to the stage where we are completely secure, or we're completely... You never really think you're at that stage. You never think that. Prabhupada didn't. He was once, you know, praying to the Lord, and the devotees asked him, what are you saying to the Lord? And he said, I'm asking that I do not be entrapped by Maya. And they were thinking, whoa, Prabhupada is asking this of the Lord. He is completely free from Maya. He's a pure devotee. And Prabhupada said, yes, because I'm always praying to the Lord like this, that is why I'm free from Maya. That because I have this mentality that I am subjected, I am, at danger of being attacked by sinful propensities at any point, that we constantly pray to the Lord to protect us from that. So that should always be our mood, that we haven't got to a stage where it's all over. We haven't reached a stage where you're in this material world, there's always a danger. So we have to just be realistic about that. Yes, Prabhuji.
Thank you for class, Prabhu. I was just wondering, in regards to thinking, feeling, and willing, you know, in regards to like sinful activities, if we kind of get to the stage of willing, is there like a way out, or do we kind of have to go with the activity and then sort of rise back up, or what's like the saving grace when one gets to, you know, the willing stage?
Yeah, typically you've lost it at the feeling point, at the point that the feeling is fully matured. You've lost it. The activity is just a standard consequence after that. Because once the activity has begun, or once it's beginning, typically our consciousness, if it's a sinful activity, our consciousness is already degraded from a state where it wants to stop it. It no longer has the desire. It's like an enemy who is attacked and attacked and attacked. And they are attacked so many times that they get beaten and beaten and beaten, and they eventually become completely ineffective. And they become just useless, and they just give up. So that's what happens to our resolve, that if we don't really get to it at the thinking stage, it will just progress further and get to feeling. It becomes more in-depth at that point, more ingrained. And then by the time that's really matured, your soldiers have gone. There's no one fighting the fight anymore. They've surrendered. And you've already committed yourself to a course of action. So your consciousness isn't even actively involved at that point. But someone else could intervene. That's why we need devotees around us. Someone else can intervene. They can say, just be careful here. I can see that this is going wrong. You're about to do something. So then you can apply this. If someone makes a strong enough presentation to you, and you have enough connection with them that you listen to them, then you can restrict. At least restrict. Try it. All the others have failed. Just do the restriction now. Stop the activity. Don't perform the activity. That won't deal with the propensity to perform such an activity in the future, but let's take step one at a time. Let's not, because every time you perform an activity, that has created a new samskara inside. It's created a new formation, something has solidified again. That addiction has increased, that inclination has just gone up again. So at least stop that bit of the process. Because it's a cycle, it doesn't really matter where you attack it from, it's just you have to get to it from all parts. If there is a root, as I mentioned, it's avidya and the desire to enjoy in this world. That's the only thing you could say is the root, somehow. And that you deal with that through the long-term process of devotional service. But at least stop the activity. But as I say, unless someone else intervenes, you probably won't. So that's why the thinking process is the one where it's there. If you find there's a certain thought that's preoccupying the mind, then that's the point to have it clarified. And a good way to clarify or a good way to process these thoughts is by actually involving the intelligence, the buddhi. Because sinful activities are not meant to be restricted by restrictive force, you know, by just determination, I'll just stop myself doing this. They have to be, and Bhakti Vigyan Maharaj explained this very nicely once, he said they have to be digested by the buddhi. By the intelligence. You bring that desire, that inclination up to the level of the intelligence. Don't let it stay at the level of the mind. The mind is a rascal, it's not to be trusted. Bring it out of that level and put it in the realm of the intelligence. And let the intelligence digest it. Let the intelligence process it and actually digest it and kind of dissolve it completely. By the intelligence can do this because it's empowered by knowledge. It's empowered by Krishna. It's empowered by instructions from the Acharya. So with that intelligence, you process it. You just ignore it, just suppress it, it will come back because it's not gone. If you digest it, there is a chance it will be gone. So different ways to attack it. You can probably deal with it through multiple ways. And eventually, hopefully, we'll we'll be more peaceful. Any other questions? Ladies? Okay. Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita ki. Srila Prabhupada ki.